Well, welcome everybody to the last panel of the day. This panel is rather appropriately placed before cocktails. Because when we get done with you and each other, you'll need them. Actually, we've tried to put this in all kinds of different places. We tried to put it at the end of the meeting, thinking that it would get people to stay. But denial runs large, and even putting this at the end couldn't get people to stay. Then we thought we'd kick it off in the morning with a lot of excitement, and everybody said, boy, you really killed the buzz. And we said, no, we're not trying to kill the buzz. We just want to make sure that the fruits of all this innovation that we've been discussed all day today and all day tomorrow will actually get paid for. So I greeted you this morning. That seems like a really long time ago, and boy, I'm much smarter right now than I was when I greeted you at 8 this morning. So hi, I'm Ed Saltzman. I'm the executive chairman, once again, at Define Health. Just want to thank everybody who worked so hard today, all the panelists, all the thinking. And frankly, it all comes down to this. How the hell do we pay for all of this? I have some terrific people on this panel. I have the pleasure of knowing most of them. Some of them I have the pleasure of meeting for the first time. I think, all have different perspectives and different views here. Some of us are more public with these views. Some of us are working behind the scenes, and most are doing both. But to address what is, I think, the biggest issue, which is quite simple, which is, the panel is called Is the Song Remain the Same? We've been whining and kvetching about cancer prices, drug prices for years, okay, for years and years and years now. I was reading some of the things I've been preparing, and I think, Kapil, it was in your marvelous article that accompanied your editorial recently, it said this goes back to chemotherapy. We've been talking about this for a really, really, really long time. But while we've been talking about it, I'll just set the stage by a few things, and then I'll let everybody we'll mix it up a little bit, all right? So a couple of things, just numbers to just set the stage. Annual global spending on cancer treatments right now is $107 billion, or at least it was in 2016. That's up 11.5% versus 2014. Cancer medicines are about $84 billion of that. That's up 14%, okay? Perhaps something promising but also concerning, if you heard those numbers, is that if you take the 10 largest pharma companies and rank them by their oncology drug sales, there's 130 late-stage drugs amongst those companies, okay? 130 drugs in late-stage clinical trials. Now, they won't all make it. Probably the majority of them won't make it. But even if a third of them make it, we're going to take a serious problem and we're going to make it worse. The growth in that spending right now is running somewhere between 7.5% and 10.5% per year. Prices are extremely up. And here's kind of the issue, right? It's kind of the problem. And I'm going to lift from one of my distinguished panelists, Dan Becker, wrote a paper in the Journal of Oncology Practice not too long ago. It's okay if I quote from that, I think. But he said something very simple, but also, I think, incredibly important. Drug benefit does not correlate with cost, and the number of high cost to benefit outliers has increased. Okay, and I think we can all agree that the cost has gone up, and we can also agree that the benefit has gone up, but the outliers have also, seriously increased. Another issue is that, and I didn't know this until I read it a few minutes ago, only six countries, you can add up six countries, and those countries have access to more than half of all the new oncology drugs today. Only six countries. I won't make you guess what they are. Obviously, they're the US, Germany, UK, Italy, France, and our friendly neighbors to the north in Canada. It's not a lot. There's an entire area called Scandinavia that's not on that list, where there's a pretty good standard of living last time I checked. We have a lot of interesting things and signs that are just pointing to the fact that, we have a problem and we have a coming problem. So We're going to talk about that problem today, and I want to introduce one thing into it, which Laura Esserman, in her fantastic talk, it really was a fantastic, fantastic keynote this morning. I hope as many of you as possible heard it, who introduced yet another topic, which isn't simply the cost of these drugs, but who are we using them in? Are we using them in the right people? Are we using them? Maybe there's a whole bunch of people where we're using expensive drugs for that we shouldn't be treating. And it's not because the payer is saying so, but because it doesn't make good medical sense to treat those patients, because in fact we're doing more harm than we are good. So we'll have to bring that in. So let me start, before I turn to the panelists, with a little bit of first, I think, what might be good news, okay? I think, and Peter's going to tell me in a minute that I'm wrong, and he'll be right, but Peter, you were the one who, I think years ago, you said something like, and don't worry, I'm not going to bring up the buffet analogy again, but I'm going to say that, you know, you said that the way we price as an industry cancer drugs was we took the last drug that was pretty similar, in fact, almost identical, and ours is 30% more, okay? There are some signs, I think, from the market that that behavior has stopped, okay? That is starting to recede, okay? So we're making some issues, and I think ASCO and the value frameworks and the fact that there are loud megaphones on the issue of pricing, and people just saying no, it's sort of starting to stop, okay? So, you know, the other thing, and it's something Peter mentioned on our call, I wasn't aware of it, but, you know, ICER is playing more and more of a prominent role in the U.S. I was aware of that. What I wasn't aware of is that it appears that the pharmaceutical industry is grudgingly, perhaps not happily, but accepting ICER as a honest broker, okay, or somebody who you might not have to immediately issue a press release after they issue theirs saying unfair, 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 unfair. It's a lousy umpire, you know, fire the umpire, right? And maybe that will provide a ceiling for pricing in the U.S., okay? I don't know if there's a floor on pricing, okay? And certainly don't think we've tested anything close to a floor. But we're getting these nice problems to have, right? So maybe what we're doing in this year, and this is, I think, the sixth year we've had this panel, so it's no longer groundbreaking, but importantly, it may actually be doing some good, all right? So I'd much rather advance things than be the first one to do it or be groundbreaking. And after 6 years, we might be getting a little bit good at this. So, you know, maybe we're moving beyond the debate as to whether the cost of cancer drugs that extend life by 3 months is worth it. Kapil, you mentioned that in one of our pre-calls, and I think it's a pretty important thing to ponder and to think about. You know, maybe we're beyond, and that's a great thing. If we really are beyond that debate, that's a fantastic thing. We've made progress, okay? And maybe we've moved on to questions like, how can we afford to pay for durable remission, right? What's the value of cure? And frankly, and more practically, how can combination regimens of novel agents be made affordable, okay? We spoke in our planning a little bit about risk-sharing arrangements based on cost of episodes of care and outcomes. And Peter, you've had a lot to say about that. And Roger, I think Peter and you may have a little bit of a
fun. We apparently fun. Disagree.
You apparently disagree, and you just found out, which is great.
No,
so
Roger
it's fresh.
Texted me.
Okay.
Yeah, I was wrong.
So we're gonna get into this trendy thing called outcomes-based contracts, and Peter going to tell you that, no, I won't take that from you. You could say exactly what you think, and Roger can as well. But before we even argue about that, I would like to give a little bit of consideration as to the issue of how long cancer drugs can remain resistant to competitive pressure. Forget what their value is, okay? We have market forces called PBMs absolutely roiling every category outside cancer. Everything in Part D. If there's a drug that looks like yours, you're gonna pay for shelf space. And every year you pay more and more and more for that precious shelf space, okay? To the tune, if it's an insulin, you might be paying 70% off that vaunted list price to get access, okay? If it's something, a diabetes drug called an SGLT2 inhibitor, you may be paying 40, 50, 60% to get access. And when your access is blocked, it's not a good time to be the CEO, because pretty soon you won't be the CEO, okay? And that is what's really happening out there in the rest of the categories. It just doesn't happen in cancer, okay? And in there's a lot of reasons, and it's very complex, and but we have to entertain the issue of market forces. And because the issue is, to me, is that Jeff put up a slide this morning. Didn't write down all the data, but Jeff, correct me if I'm wrong. I think 50 PD-1s or PD-L1s in clinical development, okay? Do we really need biosimilars? Think about it. If we have 50 PD-1s or PD-L1s in clinical development, why do we have to worry about when patents go up or when we're going to have biosimilars? Maybe we just have biosimilars being developed right now. They're just not called biosimilars. And I could do that in PARP inhibitors. I could do that across a whole bunch of categories. So I think that, you know, it's something that I'd like to reflect in our discussion today as well. And finally, and I'll quote somebody, assuming I'm organized enough to find the paper, because Peter's papers are in the way here. So let me just... I can't find it now. All right, I won't quote it. Oh, no, I will. This is from Jay Bradner. Everybody know who Jay Bradner is? He's head of Novartis Institute of Biological Research, and NIBR. All right, it's a pretty prestigious job in the pharmaceutical industry. Actually wrote a wonderful blog, okay, essentially raising the issue as to whether we're spending too much money on cancer research, on cancer drugs, okay? Because what he said is that the flood of redundant checkpoint agents is equally jarring. I'm inclined to believe that a positive storyline underlines fast follower research, enthusiasm, passion, or an overlooked indication. But I do fear that the commodity market for active cancer drugs that exists today in big pharma has inadvertently fueled redundant investment in the biotech sector with an opportunity cost to society too high for patients to bear. That's somebody from within big pharma, everybody out there in the biotech audience. So that's my stage setting. I want to leave this panel. Obviously, I want to leave this panel and have cocktails with everyone. But I don't want to really need them. All right, I want to leave this panel as if we're inspired to start to think about how we address some of these things. And in order to do that, we have to have blunt conversations. So with that, I'm not going to go in any particular order. I encourage my panelists also to be co-moderators, all right? So if Peter, you think Roger says something completely insane, you'll let him know. Roger, you will do the same thing for anybody. And the only rule is, as a moderator, I'm completely exempt from that, okay? So let me start. You know what? Instead of going down the road, why don't I start? I'm going to start with Kapil. Okay, we'll mix it up, and then we'll just get some opening thoughts, and then we'll get into the topics.
Okay. So I'll just give you share just my opening thoughts. You said a lot of things, some of which are internally contradictory, but let me just sort of state.
Let's get started.
And I'm sure you did that deliberately, such as, why do you need 50 PD-1s? And then you argue cost is too high. If you only have one, then the cost will be higher. 50, maybe first person blinks, and when the first one blinks, 39 others blink. But let's leave that aside. Just top-line thoughts. First of all, as someone who has worked in academia, half of my career, industry, the other half career, and strategy, the third half of my career, yes, cancer drug costs are real, but my first caution is let's keep it in perspective. There's a lot of hype, cancer drug costs. Cancer drug costs are still a small part of the overall equation of cancer care and overall health care. The most expensive treatment of today is not a cancer treatment, and increasingly the most expensive treatment going forward are not the cancer treatments, a $1.5 million gene therapy. Having said that, this is not to ignore the cancer cost question. It is real, very much real. And we acknowledge that. But I think we have to keep it in perspective. This is a total healthcare cost issue, not just a cancer drug cost issue, number one. Secondly, I just want to make 3 points. The second point is, while I totally understand, respect the need to come up with alternative models to price cancer drugs, the current model simply just price the highest price the market can bear is not right. We all agree with that. Even people, those of us who are from industry, agree with that. But at the same time, a model that gets onto simplistic mathematical type of models, such as nice does more or less, or any sort of quality adjusted life year models, I think it fundamentally misses the reality of oncology. In that, let me just take 30 seconds to explain what I mean. Outside of oncology, a company will develop the drug for its biggest indication, longer term indication, then put it on the market, massive launch. Oncology is the opposite. Notwithstanding all the clinical trial design improvements, the path to our biggest market or where the drug has biggest impact on patients, i.e. adjuvant, goes through metastatic disease, late line metastatic, early line metastatic before. And if you can't find a way to sort of pay for expensive drugs in the late line setting, there is no path to adjuvant for the vast majority of drugs, exceptions excluded. And the third thing is, even if you start following mathematical models, quality adjusted life year type up or other models like that, let's be careful, because one may come to regret the price of cancer drugs in that model. And I'm reminded of NICE, which is probably one of the more stringent bodies in this, recently published a hypothetical analysis that they did of CAR T therapy for pediatric leukemia, and their own conclusion was that CAR T therapy for pediatric leukemia will be justified at a price of roughly £500,000 or so, and I want to see that day when UK will pay for £500,000 for CAR T cells. So I'll stop with those sort of three top line thoughts and open it up to other panels.
Sure. Okay, now I'll take a volunteer. If I get a volunteer, I'll call on somebody.
Sure, so I'll just start with the issue of mathematical models failing. I mean, I think that there are certainly valid critiques of cost effectiveness analysis, but I think that it is essential that if you want to critique them, that you propose something better. So the problem is enormous. There's tons of data on financial toxicity to patients, and we can't just say that the best systems that are out there don't do the job. So I'll just.
Okay.
Yeah, that's interesting. So a couple of things. I don't want to just respond to your comments. I do think that, you know, it's often said that, you know, we shouldn't spend our attention on the spending for drugs because, you know, we spend so much money elsewhere. And, you know, as you inflate the denominator, that's, of course, you know, more and more true. You know, divided by all drug spending, divided by all healthcare spending, I don't know, divided by the total spending of the U.S. government, you know, it becomes less and less important. But the reality is that, and you know this just as well as I do, the rate of rise of spending of drugs, according to IMS Health, is most concentrated in oncology. It's the fastest growing sector. We're still talking about $100 billion that maybe some people in this room think is a rounding error, but I certainly don't, because it's money being taken away from other things. Any analysis you do of the cost of drugs in oncology, they are moving up faster than the benefits they provide, if you will. Even if the math is shoddy, cost-effectiveness ratios have blown up over time, even with rebates and stuff like that, which, as Ed's pointed out, are modest. But I do agree that, you know, I think cost-effectiveness is really interesting, and I think qualities are interesting. And I always think of that scene in Argo. I don't know if you've seen it, when Ben Affleck is briefing the CIA director about getting these hostages out of Iran, and they've decided to make this movie. That's, of course, the whole idea. And he says, is this the best idea you have? And he says, no, it's the best bad idea I have. And that's what cost-effectiveness is to me. So it's not that this is a wonderful, perfect solution. In fact, it's not even clear what problem exactly we're trying to solve, and let me try and explain that. But it's that it's simply better than the alternatives, which are, I don't know, cost of production plus, which I think people wouldn't really think was great, base it on the cost of research and development, kind of a input cost. Let, you know, what the market will bear is what we have now. That combined with regulatory capture, if you will. Or, I don't know, outcomes and rebates for patients where it doesn't work, but any price above it. And so I actually think this is a very hard problem, because actually what we want to do is we want to reward the risk of innovation, which is something that companies don't view as per unit, right? They kind of view it as lump sum or earnings over time. And we want to pay for it by prices per unit. So there is a fundamental disconnect just even at that point.
But But Peter, I'll turn to Roger. If the problem is we want to pay for it by prices per unit, which is the way the pharmaceutical industry has constructed itself since the beginning of time, and yet the prices per unit are too high, okay, it seems like there's only one solution, or there's only two solutions, right? And I wasn't going to get to this debate at this point in the program, but you sort of prompted me. So you either lower prices, okay, and you know that can either be done by price controls or price regulations. It can be done by market forces, as I pointed out. It's happening outside of cancer, okay? So what people don't see around the, and the reason that the drug pricing is so hysterically sensitive from a PR point for the industry is as everybody I think here knows, and most of you probably do, is that the poor people, who mostly are poor people, are people without insurance, who have lousy insurance, who wind up paying the full portion or a good slug of that list price, okay, or a percentage of that list price, which is they're the only ones paying the list price, okay? Everybody else is paying 30 or 40 or 50 or 60 or 70% of the list price. Okay, so while the list prices keep going up, the actual net prices in pharma actually aren't accelerating a lot at all. So market forces, I would submit to you, are working. They've been unleashed and they're working. They're not working in cancer, okay? They haven't worked in cancer. And we keep saying it's more complicated. Well, one thing you can do is you can regulate prices, you can unleash market forces, or you could stop selling things by the unit, okay, and say, well, we're not going to sell it by the unit, we're going to sell it by an outcome, okay, or by what that drug contributes to something else that reduces a cost or offsets a cost, right? So where are we with this, you know, in this discussion? Because this is a really, really, really important discussion right now, all right? You know, there's a, you know, I hate to even say it, but, you know, Trump is supposed to announce his great, you know, price sort of pharma pricing strategy coming up, and there are tremors, well, mild tremors, you know, on Wall Street, all right, what this is going to mean, okay, and every time there's a threat of this, and one analyst just who wasn't Mike King actually came out and said, here it is, it's going to be price controls, okay, we're going to have it, you know, the industry is incredibly vulnerable, politically the industry just has no capital, you know, everybody hates pharma. You know, it doesn't matter behind the scenes anymore. So how's this all going to shake out? You know, what do we do, and why do we have to, assuming we don't find the price regulation or lowering prices wholesale to be palatable, okay, and we can't for some bizarre reason to me, and there's a lot of reasons I know, unleash the market forces in the same way in cancer because it's more complicated, why can't we find something else? Why can't we do about something else? So I'm going to point to you, Roger.
So, Ed, can I answer the question that I'd rather answer?
Absolutely. You always do that.
There were like 50 questions.
Right.
There must be one.
You could choose one of the top 10 and, yeah. There you go.
So I think Peter did a nice job of saying here are the different ways we could think about pricing. But I guess I think about pricing in three ways. And I really wish I had heard Laura's talk earlier. I'm sorry I missed that because I think I would have learned a bunch from that. But in my view, I think there are really three ways of doing pricing, not just in cancer and anywhere. The first one is you do comparative pricing, which kind of we've done for years. And you know, this drug costs $30,000, I'll cost $30,000. If I'm a little better, I'll cost $35,000. If I'm a little worse, I'll cost $25,000. Something like that. It's comparative pricing. And that's the way most of the world works in terms of selling products. The second way is what we've been talking about and Kapil warned us against, which is sort of a value-based pricing.
Mm-hmm.
The challenge, as I think Kapil was beginning to allude to, is value-based to whom? Clearly, if you think about ICER comes up with two essential value-based prices. One is for the healthcare system, and the others is for society, but neither the healthcare system nor society actually pulls out a checkbook and writes a check. They hire agents to do that. Those agents have different incentives and goals for writing those checks. So the value-based price becomes importantly affected by the agent who has different incentives than maybe the healthcare system or society. And then finally, as we've talked about, there's risk sharing, you know, to your point, Ed, where you sort of pay for outcomes. And that has whole sets of problems and challenges as well. But when you think about those three different options, and I think those are the three options, you start having to say, well, all right, what makes sense in cancer? And oncology is kind of screwed, because in oncology, you don't have what you've got in, you don't have PBMs, essentially. They're just, they don't play, except in the oral side, and they don't, you know, play much. You've got huge provider incentives to charge money. You know, they get paid more the higher the price of the drug is often. And even, you know, the community oncologist now becoming part of the larger provider system, they get more money for expensive drugs. But then you brought up, Ed, I think one of the really cool ideas is, how do we biosimilarize the world? And the problem with biosimilarization among the PDXs is this issue of evidence. So we're now working on a couple of projects in which we say, I actually think that the Regeneron number 7 PDX, or the, I don't know if Novartis has one, somebody else has
like
one.
Like everybody else.
Okay,
everybody has one.
And then
you
number
have
12
one.
PDX.
You have one, you just don't know it.
Okay.
Right?
The number 13 PDX, whatever. Well, each one of those guys is saying, well, you know, somebody already took the really cool lung cancer indication, so I am now going to go after some really tiny little indication, so I can't be compared to the other drug, which has the really cool lung cancer indication. And therefore, when the providers see those two drugs, they say, well, wait a minute, I've got a lung cancer patient, I've got all the evidence from Opdivo or Keytruda, and I've got squat from schmucko number 12. Why should I do that? Well, I'm not going to do it. So we got this problem in the most logical way that the economic world has set prices. We can't do it. So ultimately, maybe, you know, maybe we start going towards another way of thinking about pricing, which, you know, to be really crazy, and
well,
is what.
Well, let's let me go back to what Kapil said and bring Dan in here a little bit. So because Dan, you've been very involved in the ASCO and the ESMO value frameworks, and I'm not sure, Kapil, I'm not sure Roger fairly characterized exactly what you said, but you said, you know, because we had this on the call as well, and I think to be fair, you're raising a larger point, which is that, you know, be careful what you wish for, because if, you know, society hasn't
yet determined.
Let me just
clarify the point, actually.
Right.
So,
yeah,
so there are two things. First of all,
right,
I'm not against value-based or cost-effectiveness and has been part of the equation.
Okay.
After, it would be stupid to be against that. What I'm arguing is to be just realize the reality of oncology drug development.
Right.
Notwithstanding I-SPY 2 and lung master protocols, et cetera, our drugs have the best impact, best cost effect in the adjuvant setting. Now, if you want to change the patent regime, I'm fine with it.
Right.
What you say, look, 12 years, your patent life is 12 years after the first time you launch the drug. Guess what? Industry will wait till the adjuvant trial is positive,
right,
before they launch the drug.
Right.
Is that good or bad? We can argue, right?
Right.
So that's one point. But I think value-based pricing is part of the equation,
okay,
for sure.
Right.
But the reality of oncology drug development is you have to go for some sort of late-line metastatic indication, get the risk-benefit, get the imaging data to show the drug is doing something, not be stuck like an IDO1 with 20 phase 3 running and the drug does zero, right?
Zero.
That's what you get when you try to shortcut. So that's the only point I was making, and
right,
I didn't mean to cut you.
Well, no, but I want to go to value, because, you know, when, you know, and the quote that I pulled from the Journal of Oncology Practice, Let's before we move off value, let's stay on value. And Roger's making a very good point. It says value depends on who's assessing the value, right? Or who's writing the check, I should say, as opposed to who's assessing the value.
Well, but you can finish your question. I mean, the truth is that ICER does do these different perspectives, and for many of these reports, the numbers are indistinguishable,
mm-hmm,
from the different perspectives. And also, most cancer drugs are actually purchased by government. mm-hmm. not by commercial insurance, either through government contractors like Part D or right. Medicare, Medicaid, the right. VA, Department of Defense. And they are, of course, they also have agency problems, but I think arguably, as a first order approximation, the government is the people, right? Mm. And it acts on their collective behalf, or at least that's what good governance is supposed to be about.
Yeah.
So I don't think those distinctions are yeah. academically yeah. interesting, but I think in general unimportant. So,
but how far can we go with value assessments? Let's stand that, because you know what you've essentially said is that you know the outliers are increasing. Okay, we've identified that there's a problem. How much more can we go with value assessments? How much more room is left in that tank?
I mean, much of the world, you know, has settled on cost-effectiveness analysis. I mean, the ASCO and ESMO value frameworks, I'm not sure if anyone, most people have even seen them, but I mean, they, I think, were problematic from the get-go, right? I mean, the ASCO value framework was ostensibly a bedside tool for cost-effectiveness analysis without essentially factoring in most of the costs or... Mm-hmm. So it was trying to give you a number of how good is this drug when I compare it to other drugs. And frankly, as a clinician, I'm not sure that's terribly useful at the bedside. I mean, this has to happen at mm-hmm. at a different level, because my conversations with patients are, you know, relatively consistently, you know, like they frequently want, you know, anything that gives them a chance at additional hope. Mm-hmm. And you know, and so if I tell them that, you know, and it's also relatively rare, honestly, that we're choosing between two drugs. So I think there were problems conceptually with them. I think that it was good because it started the discussion about, you know, what we think is good about a drug, right? So the things that ultimately were included were benefit, you know, whether it's overall survival versus progression-free survival versus response rate, and how you should weigh those. And in fact, ASCO's like first to second iteration, they changed the weights and it changed all the scores, mm-hmm. you know, and the weights are based on nothing. So it is very hard. I mean, I didn't mean to critique too harshly before. Like, it is very, very hard to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But this is why I do agree that the you know the best tool we have out there is cost effective analysis, and I don't think we necessarily, with all due respect to ASCO and ESMO, need a bedside tool, mm-hmm. because you can't do it thoroughly enough, and the conversations, you know, are relatively rare when you need to compare two drugs and to a patient. And then, honestly, the other side of it that's incredibly opaque to a clinician is, like, the actual out-of-pocket costs to the patient. So we're very clear on the fact that they're going up, right? There's all kinds of words like coinsurance that didn't even exist 15 years ago, in addition to co-pays and deductibles. So it's huge, but it's different patient to patient. And, I mean, you would need your prior approvals department sitting with you at the bedside. Mm-hmm. to tell you how much they're going to pay for these two different drugs and, you know, over how much time. So there are huge challenges to value, but at the end of the day, I think that we still need an answer, and we need it soon. We need it now. I mean, these patients are suffering day to day for this, or else, you know, or else we're left with just a very, very regressive system where poor patients just don't get stuff, right? Unless you're poor enough, frankly, to have Medicaid,
mm-hmm.
in which case you usually do. But anyone who's not, which is, you know, a huge chunk of the population, you know, suffers enormously. So yeah, I mean, I think we should leave today with something that everyone wants to back.
Right.
You know, I mean, lots of proposals are out there, and everyone critiques them, but we got to back something.
So go to ICER for a minute. So you're moving again from cost effectiveness, and let's stay on ICER. So did I hear you fairly, Peter, in our pre-call, where I thought you said that ICER is going to serve as a little bit of at least a ceiling for now. Their cost effectiveness reviews. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I don't think I
predicted it that strongly, okay. But I would say they're the lead horse okay. by a long stretch, and it's a race being taken very seriously. So just to focus on this for a second, so Steve Pearson runs ICER. He and I wrote a paper, it's now a number of years ago, arguing that what Dan is describing, why this matters is on two fronts. One is the spending on cancer drugs is taking away from our ability to spend on other things, right? And the other things we care about, right, collectively, whether it's society or it's, you know, companies' cash or whatever, right? And the other reason is this coinsurance and deductible and the burdens we place on patients, more than 1 million patients going into catastrophic last year or 2 years ago in Part D, for example, you know, that is a consequence of higher drug prices. And you can say the insurers are evil or something like that, but they also have to balance their books. And if they didn't do these things, that would mean we would all pay more premium. So again, same story. So it's why it matters. And the reason what's attractive about health technology assessment is it essentially simulates. It doesn't do a great job, but markets aren't great anyway at stuff like this because of lack of clarity on information. What it does is it simulates a well-functioning market. That's the theory, right? That if the market worked great and there was transparency, then just like the iPhone finding its appropriate price in the marketplace or a 32-inch flat-screen TV or a Ford Fiesta or whatever, that drugs would converge on prices due to consumers understanding what they are and buying or selling or not buying or whatever, right? And that's the idea. But because they're sole source and protected by exclusivities and we want monopoly profits because we want to drive innovation, we got nothing like that. So along comes an external body. And what Steve Pearson and I proposed a couple years ago, and then this week in JAMA, Jamie Robinson did a piece echoing the same sentiment. But we want to sort of have a bargain here. Like, the insurers are acting in ways that are adverse to patients. Pharma companies are acting in ways that are adverse to patients. How about if we have value-based prices, we have low co-insurance for drugs that have those features? And that's the bargain that companies are starting to look at, right? So Regeneron is really the only company that's done this seriously for their drug Dupixent. They launched, they didn't use their price, they went to ICER and they said, you give us your price, and then we will go to payers and say, we took ICER's price, you give us good formulary position. And then they just did for their PCSK9. It was already on the market. You could argue they got backed into it because they had a kind of horrendous launch with it, but they're going head-to-head with Amgen on this PCSK9 thing. I'd argue they have better data, but whatever. And they've said, we're going to just take a value-based price. None of this rebating, none of this outcomes-based contracting nonsense. And, you know, they want better formulary position. We'll see. I've heard signal now that maybe they've gotten it from one major payer. But there, it really stands in stark contrast to what Amgen has tried to do, which is, I don't believe in value. You know, all these companies just say, our pricing reflects the value of our products. And when you say, show us your math, they say, oh, that's proprietary.
So, Dan, wait a minute, can I just one second before, I just want to do this, and I'm gonna get you a next. We're gonna move in that order. So, because again, I meant this sincerely, that we want to come out of here with some progress towards solutions. And Dan, you represented the clinical side very, very compellingly, and you spoke, I think, quite compellingly of the needs of patients. Does any of this sound like it could be moving towards a little bit of a solution?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, value-based pricing, I think, is a very reasonable, you know, approach. I did not know actually that Regeneron had signed on for that opportunity. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. That you know, as long as we're backing some horse, as long as you know something.
So solution on the table, but Roger will now shoot it down. So
no, actually, I don't want to shoot it down. But I do want to talk about the challenge of it.
Okay.
So and talk about it in specifics. So yes, I think Len Schleifer is probably the most innovative CEO in the biopharma industry. He has screwed up several times in major ways. The first one was the pricing of the PCSK9s at $14,600. I get that. He really learned his lesson, and so he then said, I will price Dupixent at a value-based price. He worked with ICER, and they came up with a price of somewhere in the 30 grand neighborhood. He came out and said, I am pricing this at 30 grand. ICER has said it's okay. Let's go. Wall Street got behind this. Wall Street loved this. it launched the drug. First sales were not so great. Okay, we backed down expectations. Last quarter, sales of this drug were 50% below Wall Street consensus expectations. 50% below. What does that do to Len Schleifer? What he realizes is, he is a smart guy, he learns. So I am now going to price the PCSK9, reprice the PCSK9, which is to say, he is not going to change the WAC price, he is going to actually change the net price and make it available to any plan that is willing to lift the restrictions, the access restrictions, for that drug, which have prevented it from being used. Express Scripts has come out and said, for our commercial patients, roughly one-third of this marketplace, we are going to remove the need to do documentation. We will go to what is called physician attestation. That's just happened. It happened in the middle of the plan year. We're not going to know whether any plans accept this till November, maybe December. So we've got a big question mark here on whether this is going to work at all. First experiment, failure. Dupixent did not work commercially because he did not insist that plans lower access hurdles. Could this work? That's the big question right now.
Could it work?
Wait a second, Roger, you're at a biotech conference. The fact that it only performed at 50% is not a failure to biotech people, right? They had a signal, they can raise another round and go to phase two.
but is it just coincidence that the two examples that you've cited here, Dupixent and the PCSK9s, are not cancer drugs?
Well, no, it's not.
Well, we're gonna have this conversation next year, and we're gonna have the Len Schieffer of cancer drugs.
Well, I like what Dan said.
There'll be six
examples
by next year.
They will.
Yeah.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay.
I would also say, I mean, the other thing about value-based pricing, right? It only works if there's buy-in with the low-value drugs, right? It can't be that pharmaceutical companies pick and choose their most valuable drugs to be value-based priced,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it has to be that drugs that have a median survival impact of 6 weeks, you know, are also in the equation, or else the whole thing breaks down, right? Okay. Then we just get more expensive drugs.
Okay. And, you know, it's not the only signal. So Kapil mentioned this issue of you launch in metastatic and you price it a value-based price. Then you have this adjuvant, you know, Herceptin's a great example, right, where, you know, the benefit, you know, integrated across the price is just much bigger, right? So the price should be higher, right? So this approach, again, like, this is something that work we did, but indication-specific pricing is the solution that's sort of really gotten into the mainstream idea. CMS had it in a pilot that pharma killed. But the idea is, and in fact, Kymriah, Novartis had this plan that this new indication in DLBCL would have indication-specific pricing. They're trying to work with CMS. I haven't seen any announcement on it. I have a bad feeling they didn't figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay. Again, like I consider all these as just, you know, like we're going to get as far as we can get on each of these efforts. But mm-hmm. that is, you know, an attempt to,
you
know, an alternative price point.
I'm completely with you on indication specific. I think the issue becomes practicality, right? Look, what does industry do? We kind of know which indication our drug has the best efficacy. You take that as the lead indication, especially when we go to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you won't launch for an early indication if the benefit is small. Wait for better indication, get a pricing. So I think, you know, there are multiple interlinked issues. Why is it that Europe can get a lower price? Why? Very simple. They got single payer, and they tell you your drug is not getting on hospital formulary unless you agree to a certain price.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do in US? When Bush did the prescription drug benefit, first thing he gave up was Medicare can negotiate discount. Obama did Obamacare. First thing he gave up to pharmaceutical industry was Medicare will not negotiate discounts. So we understand how this works, right? And you cannot blame whoever you want. But the point is, the multiple link things are, I think patients and patient advocates have to come into the mix. We had a great discussion in the previous session with TJ there. And let me give you a historical example. There was a treatment for breast cancer in the mid-90s. which was supposedly curing something like 15, 20, 25% with metastatic breast cancer. Those days cost about $150,000, which was a lot of money. In today's dollars, will be close to $1 million. As based on largely some single-arm trial type of data. And any insurance company that didn't pay for that treatment was on the evening news. Got to a point where insurance companies stopped fighting. Laura will probably remember this one. And you know what the treatment was? Bone marrow transplantation. Mm-hmm. And how did it become mainstream standard of care? Every patient wanted it. Every academic center was seeing it as a moneymaker. This was the savior for the bone marrow transplant departments at the major cancer center. Make no mistake about it. I can speak bluntly because, you know, I used to be there, not anymore. So the point is, I think the societal expectation is, and the reason why the PCSK9 and the atopic dermatitis example doesn't quite work is, by and large in oncology, you have one drug for an indication, and until there are four ALK antagonists, there is no competition. And by the European value framework, by their calculation, crizotinib should not be reimbursed for ALK-positive lung cancer. That was their conclusion, which is what I criticized in the editorial. So what I'm saying is, yes, value, we need to take value into account. We need to be thoughtful about it. Medicare needs to be able to negotiate discounts. Societal expectations need to be reset that not everybody can claim a right to every drug that increases survival by 3 weeks in 10% of patients, because if that's what you want, prices are not coming down. I think PD-1, I've said, Jeff knows in various discussions, PD-1 may be the first example of where the pricing might go to biosimilar pricing before patent runs out. But I'm actually less optimistic that about today than I was a year and a half, 2 years ago. Why? Because the subtle differences emerging between these various PD-1s, PD-L1s, that all kind of looked same early on. Now there are enough differences emerging that the regulators are going to say, sorry guys, these are not interchangeable just because a Regeneron is approved as 6 PD-1 for squamous cell carcinoma, it can be used for everything else. No, we're not going to let you make that extrapolation. And unless that happens, nobody's going to blink. And by the way, 50 PD-1, 36 are in China, so let's not, you know, we'll have 7, 8, 9 here.
But that still leaves 14.
Yeah, at least the point it was well made. So the point I'm making is there is not a single solution to the pricing problem. You have to get to change the societal expectation over and over. Look, Avastin is a great example. When Avastin first indication, 3 month survival benefit in colorectal cancer when it was 3 months was real. Guess what? Turns out that was a salt regimen bolus. Most indication Avastin benefit has dropped to 2 weeks to 3 weeks survival benefit, and yet it's a $7 billion drug and still growing. So who's writing those prescriptions? So, you know, that's why I say these are not simple answers. We need to have action at all these four or five levels if we want to make real progress.
So we've gone through value. I'm going to move in a minute to outcomes, where I'd like to spend a few minutes. But I'd like to do that, and I think they do. But I'd like to also get to the audience and see if there's any questions. I see a hand up over there. I don't know if you want to go take the microphone, or we'll... we'll freely drift off topic if you like, or we'll stay on topic.
Hi. So I just want to pick up on one of the challenges with all these different methods for valuing drugs. They're based on average statistics for populations. And one thing that the ASCO framework does do is take into account the tail. And so these are really policy tools. They're payer tools. But when it comes to really understanding how that translates into benefit to patients, this does break down because, you know, we spent some time in the diagnostic panel talking about just how individually we have to profile to get the right drugs to the right patients. So in that context, how do we look at pricing for a drug that only adds 3 weeks? Is that for all the patients, or are we missing the boat that there is a small population that really does benefit, and should we be looking at value-based contracting?
Can I answer? Just thank you for the question. Just a technical clarification. The way you've characterized the math is incorrect. So this is obviously a common industry talking point that's been propagated, but it's, you know, deeply inaccurate. the way these models are done. Now, the drug abacus, which I created, but Roger did all the back office, so all the errors are Roger's fault. the drug abacus does use median, but the drug abacus is intended as a thought experiment. But ICER does what's called microsimulation models, where they actually model out, you know, for some very long period of time, 10 years, 20 years, entire populations. And what they then do is they get the average benefit, which incorporates that tail. Now, you could argue that the tail should have more value for later days, or you could argue that prospect theory pertains and the tail should get fewer values. But either way, saying that the tail is ignored is just plain wrong. So the other, sorry, you want to respond?
Yeah, if I could.
Okay. Well, no, I just said you could argue that days far out should be excess weighted, like we value days 10 years from now more or less or the same.
What I'm arguing is you should be looking at patient tranches. And if you've got a real benefit on your tail, you don't want to muddle that in. You look at that population, and at that point, what you're saying is this has a lot of value. This has nothing.
Yeah, so fair enough. The other point I want to make is you have to remember that, you know, this isn't a marketplace where people are buying their own medicines. It just isn't, right? And when we're talking about, I mean, there's a few people maybe who could pay, you know, millions of dollars for meds or something. These are societal allocations that are being distributed for the benefit of individuals. That's what we're doing. It's the same thing when you call the fire department, they're only saving one house, right? But we all pay for it through taxes and stuff like that. So the individual patients fundamentally make up a population, and the benefit is being purchased by society through a gazillion different means, including tax credits and all this other stuff. But still, these are population-level questions. And the fact that some of the patients kind of do great and others don't do great, I mean, I wish more for the ones who don't do great, of course, but we are still buying the average. And like I said, there is some math in here. We could overweight the long tail, we can underweight the long tail, but still, you are buying the expected value of that medicine. If you know what the subgroups are, you can have indication-specific pricing. These people are going to do mediocre, these will do great. We can have two different prices in the market, you're still buying the average.
Laura?
Yeah, so I talked about this a little bit this morning, but I'm just wondering, you know, instead of thinking about once they're on the market, you know, what about an experiment going forward where we say, okay, if you reach an early indicator that your drug is really effective in a particular subset, that we run an experiment where we say, okay, we'll fast track that to market in exchange for your getting a fast way where we're actually accruing the data, where the cost of development really does come down. Can we capitalize on that to say, okay, now is pharma going to be willing to put the drug on the market at a lower price to guarantee that it's in this kind of, I call this accelerated approval regulatory evidence generation, this model with the FDA, and bring payers into it where, you know, the FDA can't set price, of course, but they can say, we only give it if we have all the data.
Yeah.
You know, it's an experiment. Will pharma want to play with that, say, in exchange for a guarantee that they're going to get a faster track forward, that they're going forward, not going backward, going forward, put the drug in the market at a lower place. So you're guaranteeing a lower price, but you're making them, you know, cost something effort. Everyone's got to give in this model. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Brian, you're next, or I don't know, somebody. So who's ever got the microphone? Brian, you.
So
got the microphone.
Jeff pays me $1 every time I ask any question, and he pays me $2 if I ask something provocative. So I think this panel next year ought to be called How Do We Reduce Total Drug Cost? So Peter, I'm sure you'll correct me on this. I believe at the moment the cost of drugs in cancer care is approximately 15%. I may be wrong on that. biosimilars are less than 25% less than the cost. Point number two, I'm going to make six brief points.
Did you get $2 each?
maybe there'll be synergy and we'll get
it's
a
like
bonus.
Fee for service questions.
So not sequencing a diagnosis will be malpractice in 5 years' time. So we treat incredibly aggressively, neoadjuvantly and adjuvantly. And I hate to say this, but since I've been in my current job, which is now almost 4.5 years, we've not had one relapse from neoadjuvant to breast cancer. The total cost of that has not exceeded $400,000. Our hospitalization rates run at 2.5%. We're told that MD Anderson's runs at 25%. We're basically getting no hospitalization. Every metastatic patient in our hospital costs an average of over $1 million. So if we could go to genomics incredibly early, using the drugs very aggressively in combination upfront, and completely avoid metastatic disease, the prices of the drugs becomes a little less important. But the overall cost of care is significantly reduced.
Good point, and thank you. So I don't know how much Jeff you owe Brian, but I want to also bring, because Laura posed a question as well, and I don't think we answered it. I was tempted to take out a calculator, but I can't do this on a simple calculator. You know, it would be the pharma industry, the answer is the pharma industry will run financial models on that kind of, you know, proposal. I think it's quite an intriguing proposal. And I think it's going to be enabled by science. And I think that may have been your underlying point. And I think you're correct. And I think that may be a way to move this forward. And that may be something that we call indication-specific pricing as well. We just don't recognize it as a current indication, right? So
I'm wondering, Ed, I guess I'm just curious just to probe a bit further. What you're suggesting is if they can get to the market cheaper, will they cost less, right?
So. They should. If it were a rural marketplace, it would.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe.
Not.
Well, there's actually been that experiment run in a kind of weird way, but sort of the inverse way, where we've got these priority review vouchers. And the priority review voucher says you can buy one from another company.
Prices are way down.
And mm-hmm. the price started at 60, went up to 350, and is now settled at around 120 to 150 million bucks. But that's paying forward the idea, whether you will do these mathematical models and figure out whether that actually was a good thing for the drug company or not. In most cases, it's, in my view, not. But
I think, Laura, you were suggesting, perhaps, let me make sure I understood, suggesting that a drug could be put on the market with less than sort of final data set and you charge lesser price in return for that early market access. Is that what you were suggesting?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And data.
So I think that, so what has happened is actually, so the first part of that was done and the second part kind of never happened. So the whole accelerated approval notion was, in fact, on response rate, for example, you get accelerated approval. If you look at prices of drugs that are put on accelerated approval, they are no less than anything else. If you ask Rick Pazdar, at various times at ODEC, he used to argue, I don't need to give accelerated approval because if you really care about the patient, you can give expanded access, and expanded access a larger charge cost plus something, and of course no industry would ever take him up on that expanded access because they want approval. I think the pendulum has swung in the opposite direction than where you are suggesting, actually. What the Breakthrough Act has done now with the way drugs are getting approved, I think we are some distance away from making something like that happen.
Good. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So I wonder if, so I wonder if the PCSK9 example actually starts to shed some light on that. Because when you start thinking about value-based pricing and the cost-effective analysis that ICER did, you could influence the pricing in one direction or the other depending on the patient population that you were actually indicating that drug for and doing the analyses for. So if you were really looking at value-based pricing and starting to think about bringing precision medicine into that, then you could theoretically get to a point where you could incentivize development of a drug for a specific patient population where there's going to be the highest benefit, and it's not necessarily going to bring the price down, it's actually probably going to bring the price up.
Right.
So for example, if Regeneron had said, okay, we're just going to look at patients who have the greatest benefit, it's a very small population, the cost-effective analysis is going to set the pricing much higher. So I guess my question is, thinking about this in oncology, if there were to be a shift in using ICER or cost-based analysis that they're doing, do you think that that actually incentivizes precision medicine, using precision medicine in development, and changing kind of the dynamic of what data is being incentivized or what data is actually being looked at through the development process and not just retrospectively once you're trying to figure out how to negotiate pricing on the back end?
I'm going to let the panel take a shot at that, but I want to just point out one thing that I was reading your editorial, Kapil, earlier. And actually, you made the point, and it's something I've made previously, not that I'm claiming credit for it, but because it's like a counterintuitive, it doesn't make intuitive sense. You know what I'm going to say? You made the observation that personalized medicine actually increases costs.
Absolutely.
Okay? So I'm not going to answer your question. I'm going to let the panel answer it, but I want to make that observation. Yep.
No, please. What we're trying to do is buy health or improvements in health. So this isn't actually just about how much we spend, which seems tilted towards the high end, but it's about efficiency. And so I actually think your question, it's difficult to predict the direction. If you think about most products, you can fundamentally ignore the cost of manufacturing them. All the price is in the monopoly. So there might be a strategy where like, hey, it doesn't work that well, but I can treat gazillions of people. And so like that works out. And there might be another model where like, it goes like gangbusters and it's only 10 people, but like that's better math. And so I think it's hard to know, but the theory of this cost effectiveness thing is we are trying to use societal resources to buy a certain amount of health instead of fixing the subway with those dollars. And that's the trade we're trying to make.
Do you know what happened to Kapil today?
Right. Trust me. I was
stuck in the number one train for an hour. So.
I was cursing Vertex this morning because they won't give a discount on Orkambi to New York State, and I was stuck on the M train, which the state could use money to fix if, you know, Jeff Lyden didn't need a jet.
I was stuck on the one train for an hour,
so. The one train. Another thing, you should call Jeff Lyden, you know, because he might be able to pick you up.
The train.
Not on the ground.
Anyway. Not on the ground. I'm sure he has other vehicles.
I think the question of personalized medicine, look, I don't want commercial cynical commentary. Really. Personalized medicine is for real. Brian is giving you many examples. He's probably further ahead than most people. When I did the Roche Oncology 2020 strategy, this was way back in 2005, has been publicly presented. We outlined by 2020, metastatic cancer will become chronic disease. My own discovery had sort of thought I was insane. We said every patient's tumor will be fully sequenced at initial diagnosis, select phosphoproteome analysis, selected immunohistochemical markers, and it will be repeated several times in the natural history of patients. Here we are in 2018, nobody argues with that anymore, and those days nobody believed us when we said it. But we have to think forward now. I think because we heard a lot of discussion of value-based pricing. I'll give you one simple fact. Look at the market cap of Loxo Oncology and Blueprint Medicine. $3.4 billion and above $3 billion. they got kinase inhibitors essentially that work for ultra small subset of patients, rare sarcoma, a couple of hundred patients, et cetera. Why? Because patients have been in remission 1 year, 2 years, and everybody knows what the pricing is going to be. Mm-hmm. So this is why I was cautioning. I'm not against value-based pricing. I'm just saying the more personalized you beg, if you become as smart as Brian is, where you can combine three or four targeted drugs for any given patient based on phosphatase and phosphoproteome profile, and you put a patient in remission for 4 years, 5 years for that, I'm sorry, but the price of that, if you're really going to be value-based pricing, you're looking at numbers that's north of where we are today. This doesn't mean you should start giving ineffective therapy to everybody and give Avastin, because you know it has been said before cynically, the best thing for insurance companies is for the patient to die sooner, right? Of course, we don't want that. We want best medicine for the right patient, but we should not kid ourselves. As long as you're in a capitalist system of healthcare and a market-based pricing, cost of true personalized based medicine is going to be high.
I got to say, with it, with.
I'm with you.
Ever coming back.
Yes.
And that's less than $400,000. And Ed, I'm going to lovingly correct one thing that you said. Targeted therapies, personalized therapies, at the metastatic stage, cost a large amount.
Mm-hmm.
I've got people on 14th, 15th
yes.
line,
yes.
metastatic therapy.
Mm-hmm.
But at the neoadjuvant, it's all over in 2 years,
mm-hmm.
and the drugs don't continue.
Right. So one of they whatever they pay the moderator at this conference, it's too much because it's really easy. So we're gonna go to Lou over here.
Thanks, Ed. So I'm hearing that we're landing on value-based pricing as a potential model for setting the price for cancer drugs. I heard that ICER pronounced value for money with a $500,000 price tag on CAR T therapy. CAR T was initially approved by the FDA for young kids with acute leukemia, 4,000 new patients a year. Now it's been approved for aggressive lymphoma, 40,000 patients a year. Ken Anderson, you know, pronounced that it will be approved for multiple myeloma in the next year or so. That's another 20,000 patients per year. So my question isn't about pricing. My question is, does anybody have a clue about how we're going to afford this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, first of all, Laura, I just want to say, I don't think, and we'll run out of time, so we won't, you know, be able to conclude here. I don't actually think we concluded that value-based pricing is necessarily the answer. I think value-based pricing is a tool. And I think that it's a tool that that I think you will start to see the evident impact of this, you know, a lot more. We didn't get to talk about outcomes-based pricing. We didn't get to talk about risk sharing. I got an article by Peter here within the last year that's got 11 good reasons why we shouldn't do risk sharing, outcomes-based contracts, which you might otherwise, you know, call risk sharing. Peter's challenging me and saying, I don't know if I ever saw that before, Ed, but there they are.
Oh, yeah,
right. Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, you did it. Yeah. Okay, you said it. You know, and Peter just doesn't want the industry to get away with getting rid of, you know, Medicare best pricing, right? So, you know,
and anti-kickback.
Right,
and
right. But so we're not simply saying, you know, and I don't think there is actually, you know, an answer that this panel is going to come up with as to how we afford it. Particularly if you believe even the third of those drugs that I cited that are in late stage trials, and that's not the ones behind them, and that's not everything in combination. Okay,
wait,
so
I have an answer. Can I?
Okay. Good. Then we can go
so,
drink.
So it does.
We
sorry. Yeah, but I want to answer Lou's question because it's a fair one. So the idea of value-based pricing is it is for sole source drugs where there isn't effective competition. And there's lots of regulatory capture that avoids competition, but we do have to believe that we could get over that too. And so in the CAR example, like Kymriah now has the adult DLBCL approval. Like I wanna see Yescarta and Kymriah go head to head in some way. And you can tell me, you're the expert, you can tell me that's through an RCT and there's a winner, that's through a bundled payment and then we let the providers decide, that's through a consolidated payment code and they average each other down. But what ICER said is right. Like, the value-based benchmark, in the absence of competition, is that number. And, like, you know, it depends on a bunch of assumptions. But, yeah, 400,000 or 500,000 But these guys should be beating each other up tomorrow.
Well, that's what I was saying.
And then we'll see. They should go to zero profit in the classic sense. There'll be, and there's going to be a dozen more. And we'll see what happens in myeloma. But Juno's got a construct. And I guess Celgene owns the other construct that should have competed with it too, or at least half of it. So I don't know about that. But we'll see. There's a whole new FTC. We'll see about that.
I'm going to run for another 5 minutes or so. I'll take another question, and then I'll go to any closing thoughts, and then we'll go drink.
Just a quick one. So how do we justify, or how, for a question that comes up by the naive taxpayer, the average person, tell me, how is it possible that we're paying $10,000 a year, $50,000, $500,000 a year in cancer, where in Alzheimer's, standard of care, the best drugs out there, which are equivalent to, I would say, to some of the cancer drugs in their efficacy, symptomatic only, but a couple of grand a year. Insulin, you stop taking insulin, type 1 diabetes, you're going to die. Half $500, $800 a year per patient. Mm-hmm. How do we justify the 100-fold, even more, that we're paying for some of these cancer drugs? I think that's just something that is a naive question, maybe. Mm-hmm. But how do we handle that?
Can I add to that? You can't get any development going in antibiotics for you know, carbapenem resistant, you know, bacteria, triple drug resistant. You can't get, because nobody thinks they can charge more than $10,000 for a course of treatment. But those are life saving drugs, okay? If you happen to be unlucky. And you get that. So people are unlucky, they get diagnosed with cancer, they're unlucky, they go into a hospital, they get a nasty resistant bug. You know, and yet, you know, painfully, when we look from our perspective at Defiant Health, we have clients struggle terribly, you know, trying to come up with novel science on there. So it's a very good point, you know, but I don't think it's so much that, you know, well, I think the issue with value-based pricing is that it's the first move to perhaps crudely, okay, say we can justify the price. The price is justified. That doesn't necessarily mean, to Peter's point, that the societal cost, okay, can necessarily be justified. But to Kapil's point, which he's written eloquently about, and I suggest you read it, you know, there are some downsides to starting to, you know, ration and think about that because of, you know, where we are.
It's a great question. Let me try and clarify the problem we're trying to solve. Right. So the way markets work is the companies that sell products where there's competition never get to capture the value of their product. That's the deal. That's why we walk out of Best Buy with huge TVs, because we look and be like, it may be $800, but I value this thing at like $4,000. And that's what's called consumer surplus, right? The $3,200 in there, right? This thing I would pay $1,000 a month for my monthly contract, right? For sure. So I'm getting all that. Some days I'd pay zero. But anyway, so I'm getting all that surplus. The way we've constructed pharmaceutical innovation rewards is that you get this thing, you take these risks, you get approved, then we give you this exclusivity. Some of it's patents, some of it's FDA. There's a whole bunch of stuff in there. But we give you this brief runway. We get to charge vastly more than you would if other people got to make the exact same drug, which would be driven to zero profit. When it's over, we let generics come in or biosimilars, which will never work or whatever, right? But you just have this window. And the problem we're trying to solve is that when you have a sole source drug, you have not only a monopoly, but you have a sort of an ungodly monopoly where there's no competition. You can literally just charge almost whatever you want, up to the point where you're afraid Congress will stop you and start passing laws and stuff. And that has turned into a gross inefficiency in the market, with the rewards being too large, leading to other sorts of things causing problems. So we aren't trying, the goal is not to transfer all the societal wealth to pharma companies at the limit of the value they provide, because that's not how markets work. The goal is create a prize. And the way we've decided to do this prize is through unit pricing monopolies. And so what should that price be? So it's a very specific economic market failure we're trying to solve.
We're not trying to say pharma gets, because nobody in the competitive market gets to keep all the surplus except monopolists.
Okay. I'm going to take one more question, and then we're gonna have to wrap it up.
This was a comment to a previous part of this conversation. I'm kind of losing the track here, but I just wanted to mention how you can distinguish the cost effectiveness from the budget impact. And what happens in the UK, you can have a drug that is cost effective, but they will cap how much they'll spend a year at 20 million pounds. And so if you look at a case like Hep C, they'll take the sickest patients first. They'll clear them out. Next year, next tranche, clear them out. This doesn't work in cancer because you're gonna lose your patients. So they do have other negotiating tools. They had the cancer fund. That's changed. They're getting rid of that. Now NICE reviews that. But they give you a chance to build up your evidence while they're paying for it and then figuring it out. But you still have the budget issue. I'm not saying this is a solution. I'm just mentioning that you can disconnect those two issues. You know, in the US, what ends up happening is you've got commercial plans putting all kinds of hurdles and restricting who gets access. So effectively, they're doing the same thing.
I'm sorry.
So I think it's great that we focused on the whole day on a very lively conversation about sort of large picture things that could be changed. But I think that there are some low-hanging fruit as well that never got addressed today, right? So, Peter, you had a paper, right, on wastage in vial size, right? There is a recent paper on abiraterone dosing, right, where, like, pharmaceutical companies should be doing these trials. I mean, pembrolizumab seems like it's probably as effective at 2 milligrams per kilogram as it is at 200 milligrams as a flat dose, and that's, like, over, you know, 1.5 times the dose.
Even Merck will say.
So right. can I ask you a question? So actually, this is fast. No, we have to spend 2 minutes on this one, okay? Because I'm also on the NCI CRADA.
All right, I get paid overtime.
No, because I'm also on the
NCI. Everyone else can go for drinks.
No.
we're not leaving.
No, because I think it is so crucial for the direction. We have talked a lot about NIH, NCI today, and the cooperative groups, and advocacy groups, and Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. So you're absolutely right. There's so many things. When I sit in the NCI CRADA committee, which CRADAs get the highest score? Novel, innovative drug, expensive drug, right? Very simple. NCI cooperative groups, tell them thou shall be doing non-inferiority trials to make sure you prove that the old drug is Adriamycin as good as any new chemotherapy drug, and then that's the standard of care per NCCN. Instead, we do the opposite. All the cooperative groups want a novel, sexy, new drug, but that's what everybody wants to do. What does NCCN do? Bring me phase two single arm data, I put it in NCCN guidelines. So I think this is part of the, you know, we are all in it together. Academia, industry, patients, advocates, NCI, we're all together. If you really want to bring the Pembro trial, frankly, Merck would never do that trial. Why should they? They're a for-profit entity answerable to their shareholder. They will not do $100 million trial, but why does an NCI take that on? Say, okay, we will do this. I can guarantee you the outcome today. The cheaper regimen will not be inferior.
Well, in the case of Pembro, Merck has said the two doses are equivalent.
No, I know that.
Yeah.
No, but also you can get a short duration, for example. Most companies are doing 2 years PD-1. I think Regeneron is the only one doing 1 year. Most of us are reasonably sure 1 year is not going to be worse than 2 years. Why is not that NCI doing that? Those should be high priorities from a societal perspective. Why not?
Okay, Okay, all right. I am gonna wrap it up because we are running really over time and cocktails await us. So I'll look forward to seeing everybody at the reception, and we'll continue this conversation there. And I just want to thank my panelists for another really lively and hopefully forward-moving discussion. So it was great.